Imagine for a moment that you are drawing up blueprints to build a house.
Okay.
You submit these highly technical diagrams to the city, right? But before you break ground, a master architect pulls you aside.
And they probably have some notes.
Oh, they have major notes. They look at your plans and explicitly tell you that your load-bearing calculations are, well, they're physically impossible.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like if you build it this way, gravity will simply not work the way you want it to. The roof is going to cave in.
Right, a total disaster.
Exactly. Now imagine you just nod, take the blueprints back, and build the house anyway, exactly as drawn.
Just completely ignoring the architect.
Completely. And today we're looking at a paper published in a prestigious materials science journal that essentially did exactly that.
It really is a striking case study because we tend to view published peer-reviewed science, especially in the hard sciences like metallurgy or advanced physics, we view it as a realm of absolute objective truth.
Right, like it's flawless.
Exactly. But the reality of how theoretical models are built and, how they actually get published is sometimes far more complicated and honestly a lot messier.
So, welcome to the deep dive. If you are someone who relies on data or models or theoretical frameworks in your daily life, which is most of us, this is a massive warning sign.
Yeah, about what happens when the math stops matching reality.
Exactly. So today we're looking at a direct request to critique a specific research paper. And to do that, we are grounding our discussion in a very comprehensive commentary written by HKDH Padatia.
Right, he operates out of the Queen Mary University of London and the University of Cambridge.
And his commentary focuses on a paper by Wang, Dai, Sun, and several others, I believe.
Yeah, that paper was published in Scripta Materialia back in April of 2026.
Okay, April 2026. Got it.
And essentially, Wang's team proposed an energy barrier model for calculating the start temperature of Widmansdottir ferrite.
Which we often just abbreviate as Ws.
Exactly, WS.
Okay, but before we go any further into the weeds here, what exactly is Widmansdottir ferrite? I mean, we need a clear picture of what this metal actually looks like before we talk about how it forms.
Sure. Think of it as a very specific needle-like or plate-like crystal structure.
Needles or plates? Okay.
Right, and it forms inside steel during the cooling process. So when you're manufacturing steel, understanding the exact temperature at which these plates begin to form, that W start temperature, is absolutely crucial.
Because it changes the metal.
Exactly. It dictates the microstructure.
Yeah.
And that microstructure, in turn, dictates the strength, the toughness, basically the overall physical properties of the final metal.
So if you want to control the steel, you really have to accurately model how and when this ferrite grows.
Yeah, getting the model right is high-stakes engineering. You can't just guess.
But here's where it gets really interesting, the timeline of this whole publication.
Oh, the timeline is wild.
Right. Because Badishia didn't just like read this paper in April and decide to write a post-publication critique on his blog or something.
No. He spotted these fundamental physical errors months earlier.
Months. He forwarded his corrections directly to Professor Dai in January of 2026.
And we really have to pause and acknowledge how the scientific peer review process usually works here.
Yeah, break that down for us.
Normally, a paper is submitted, then blind reviewers suggest edits, and the authors revise it. It's a whole back and forth.
Right, the standard process.
But here, you have a leading expert in the field bypassing the blind review, going directly to the authors months in advance, and detailing exactly why the core mathematical model contradicts physical reality.
And yet the paper was still pushed through to publication in April, maintaining all those core
Oh.
framework.
Yeah, they basically just ignored the architect and built the house anyway.
That is wild. So our mission today is to understand what actually went wrong in Wang's model. We want to look at the mechanisms they proposed, why these physical and mathematical errors matter, and, what it teaches us about model drift.
Model drift, right? That dangerous space where brilliant scientists get so caught up in balancing a mathematical equation.
Just making the numbers look pretty.
Exactly. They get so caught up that they lose sight of the physical world they're actually trying to describe.
And what's fascinating here is that we shouldn't view Wang's team as incompetent, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, modeling atomic transformations is incredibly, almost unfathomably difficult.
Because you're dealing with atoms.
Atoms, complex differential equations, intense thermodynamics. It is very easy to fall into a trap where you tweak a variable just to make the math resolve.
sacrificing real-world physics for mathematical convenience.
Precisely.
Well, let's start right there with the math, because
Yeah.
according to Padesia, the foundational equations Wang's team used are fundamentally flawed from, like, step one.
Yeah, the very foundation.
He specifically points out that Wang's basic equation for the, let me get this right, the solid solution strengthening of austenite is incorrect.
Right. And to understand why that matters, we need to know what that term actually means.
Please, because it's a mouthful.
So, austenite is a high-temperature phase of steel, and solid solution strengthening is a basic metallurgical concept.
Okay.
Think of it like dissolving sugar into a glass of water.
Okay, I can picture that.
In steel, you are dissolving alloying elements like carbon or manganese into the solid crystal lattice of the iron.
And what does that do?
Those extra atoms distort the lattice, which actually makes the metal stronger. It is a foundational property of the material.
Oh, so it's the baseline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If your baseline equation for how the metal achieves its basic strength is wrong, well, every single calculation built on top of it is going to inherit that error.
Okay, let's unpack this, because it gets way more complicated when Wang's team introduces a variable they call the resistance to interface motion.
Ah, yes. The mythical resistance.
Right. Basically, their model relies on this force that pushes back against the ferrite as it transforms and grows. And Padesia outright calls this force mythical.
He literally uses the word mythical, yeah.
He says the growth rate can be perfectly explained if you just set this resistance to zero. But hold on, I want to challenge Padesia here for a second.
Okay, play devil's advocate.
If a metal crystal is physically growing and pushing its way through surrounding solid steel, wouldn't there naturally be some kind of friction? Or resistance? Like, why is it so absurd for Wang's team to assume there's a resistance force?
That is a really great question, because macroscopic intuition, the way we experience the world, tells us that pushing through a solid requires force, you know, to overcome friction.
Right, if I push a block across the table, it drags.
Exactly. But at the atomic level, a displacive transformation isn't like pushing a wooden block across a table. The atoms aren't grinding against each other in the way we think of friction.
But what are they doing?
They are shifting their positions in a highly coordinated, almost military-like formation to change the lattice structure.
Oh, it's an organized shift.
Right. And Padesia points out that when you look at the established physics of this specific transformation, the resistance to that interface moving is negligible. It's effectively zero.
But Wang's team didn't treat it as zero?
No. By inventing a massive hurdle that the metal supposedly has to jump over, Wang's team then had to build a complex mathematical framework to explain how the metal actually manages to jump over it.
So they created a problem that didn't exist and then congratulated themselves for solving it.
Pretty much. And that leads to a massive contradiction in their energy calculations.
Oh, the energy numbers. This part blew my mind.
It's bad. The paper claims that the interfacial energy, which is basically the energy at the boundary between the growing ferrite plate and the surrounding austenite, they say it's 0.23 joules per square meter.
Okay, 0.23.
But Padesia ran the numbers using the exact parameters Wang's team provided for their own barrier model. And the actual calculation comes to 2.3 joules per square meter.
2.3, which is a 10 times discrepancy.
Exactly, a factor of 10.
That is not a rounding error. I mean, if someone tells you a car weighs 2,000 pounds and it actually weighs 20,000 pounds, you're dealing with a completely different physical reality.
It's a totally different vehicle at that point.
Plus, Padesia notes they invoke the diffusion of molybdenum with zero credible justification.
Yes, the molybdenum issue.
What does molybdenum usually do, and why is dropping it in here such a red flag?
Well, molybdenum is a heavy alloying element. It's often used to increase the strength of steel at high temperatures.
Okay.
And importantly, it moves very sluggishly. It's slow. So if you suddenly introduce molybdenum diffusion into a model about a specific low-temperature start temperature, it drastically alters the thermodynamics.
It changes the whole math equation.
Right. And if there's no physical justification for being there, it highly suggests the authors just needed an extra variable to bridge a gap in their math.
They needed to balance their imaginary ledger.
Exactly. They needed a number to make the equation work. So they just dropped in molybdenum.
It's like forcing a puzzle piece into the wrong spot just because it has a flat edge.
That's a perfect analogy.
So if the math is trying to force an outcome like that, how does that warp the physical shape of what they're actually describing?
Well, this is where it gets visual.
Because Padishia argues that this reliance on mythical forces forced Wang's team to make physically impossible assumptions about the geometry of the steel itself.
Yeah, this is where the disconnect between a differential equation and a physical microscope becomes glaring.
How so?
As we mentioned earlier, Widman-Stettin ferrite forms as these elegant, thin plates, right?
The needles.
Right. To mathematically model how these plates grow over time, Wang's team decoupled the lengthening of the plates from the thickening of the plates.
Decoupled them.
Yes. They essentially wrote equations that treat the plate growing longer and the plate growing wider as two completely independent events.
But wait, why would they do that? Why decouple them if it's a single physical plate of metal?
Simply because mathematical models of crystal growth are notoriously complex.
Okay.
You're dealing with coupled differential equations, which are incredibly difficult to solve.
They're messy.
Very messy. So by uncoupling length and width, Wang's team made their equations infinitely easier to solve on paper. It was a choice made purely for mathematical convenience, but it completely sacrificed physical reality.
Because Hadashia argues that these processes are strictly coupled. I mean, the shape of the ferrite is constrained by the deformation that accompanies the transformation.
Exactly. The atoms are shifting together.
I'm picturing this like a physical zipper.
Oh, I like that.
Like, you can't pull one side of a zipper track without the other side physically moving and locking into place alongside it. It's a coordinated motion.
Right.
Treating the growth of this metal like drawing a rectangle on a computer screen where you can just click and drag the length out completely independently of the width, that just doesn't work with physical atomic lattices.
The zipper analogy is highly accurate, and Fidacia points out the logical traps you fall into when you pretend you can uncouple them.
What?
Well, if lengthening and thickening were truly independent, the aspect ratio of the plates wouldn't match what we actually observe under a microscope.
Oh, the shapes would be all wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And furthermore, physical observation shows that the lengthening rate of these plates is constant.
Okay, it grows at a steady pace.
Right. But if length and width were uncoupled, that lengthening rate wouldn't be constant, because the diffusion of carbon would affect the tip and the sides differently in a way that their model just doesn't account for.
And to try and justify this uncoupling, Wang's model assumes that the carbon enrichment along the sides of the growing plate is exactly zero.
Yes.
Which Kadeshia literally calls a bizarre assumption.
It is bizarre.
Yeah.
Because it defies basic physical chemistry.
Where does the carbon go then?
Well, as the plate grows, carbon is rejected from the growing ferrite plate into the surrounding steel. To assume it just magically doesn't accumulate on the sides of the plate is, again, tweaking a physical reality to make the math easier to solve.
And Fidacia brings up an elementary physical proof to show how linked these processes actually are.
The hard obstacle proof.
Yes. He points out that observation clearly shows the thickening of a Widman-Stettin plate stops the moment the tip of the plate hits a hard obstacle, like an austenite grain boundary.
Exactly. It is a physical object moving through physical space.
Right.
The atoms have to obey the laws of physics. If the length stops growing because it hits a literal wall, the thickening also stops. They are coupled.
You can't just keep dragging the width of the rectangle on your screen once the length hits a physical barrier.
You really can't.
The fact that they treated physical space so casually explains their next massive oversight.
Oh, boy.
Because if you don't understand how the metal grows, you definitely aren't going to understand how it starts.
No, you won't.
And this brings us to the core stated goal of Wang's entire paper.
Yeah.
Calculating the start temperature, the Ws.
Right. You would think a paper dedicated to calculating a starting point
right.
would pay very, very close attention to the starting conditions.
You would think.
But this leads us to what is perhaps the most staggering conceptual error in the whole thing. To have a start temperature in metallurgy, you must have a starting event.
Which is called what?
Nucleation. It is the initial spark. It's the moment when the atoms first arrange themselves into the new crystal structure, overcoming an initial energy barrier to create a new surface before the plate can actually begin to grow.
But according to Padishia, Wang's method completely ignores nucleation.
Completely ignores it.
The model just assumes these metal plates materialize out of thin air, fully formed enough to start growing.
Just poof, they're there.
Wait, I want to play devil's advocate for a second again. Is it possible Wang's team just wanted to focus purely on the growth phase? Like, is it really that big of a deal to emit nucleation if you're mostly just modeling how the energy changes as it expands?
It is a massive deal, because you cannot calculate a true start temperature without calculating the energy required to actually initiate the start.
Okay, that makes sense.
Creating a new surface in a crystal lattice requires a significant amount of energy. If you ignore nucleation, you are ignoring a huge chunk of the thermodynamic ledger.
So their math is missing a huge number.
Exactly. It's like trying to calculate the exact amount of fuel a rocket needs to reach orbit, but deciding to just omit the energy required to launch it off the launch pad because the math of the ascent is easier to focus on.
It's a paradox. You're calculating the start of a race, but pretending the starting gun doesn't even exist.
That's a great way to put it.
And it gets worse, because it's not just the starting line they got wrong, it's the fuel they're using to run the model.
Ah, the carbon dependence.
Yeah. Wang's entire framework relies fundamentally on carbon diffusion to work. The math only functions if carbon atoms are actively moving around.
Which brings up a fatal flaw. This raises an important question. What happens when there is no carbon?
Is that that thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There is an entire class of materials known as interstitial free steels.
Interstitial meaning the spaces between the iron atoms in the lattice, right?
Precisely. Carbon atoms are very small, so they sit in those interstitial spaces. But interstitial free steels are specifically manufactured to remove these elements. They effectively have no carbon.
Oh, wow.
So because Wang's team relied entirely on carbon diffusion to make their mythical resistance model work, their model completely falls apart and cannot address transformations in interstitial free steels at all.
Let me try to steel man Wang's team just one more time.
Give it your best shot.
What if they just set out to build a model specifically for carbon-heavy steels? Is it really fair to critique them for failing to model a completely different type of steel?
It is fair, actually, because the physical mechanism, the displacive transformation that creates Widman-Stettin ferrite, it occurs in both types of steel.
Oh, so the underlying physics is the same.
The driving thermodynamic force is exactly the same. A true, robust energy barrier model describing the physics of this specific lattice change shouldn't fundamentally break down just because you remove an element that isn't supposed to be the sole physical driver in the first place.
I see.
By relying on carbon just to balance their math, they severely limited the real-world application of their own theory.
Which brings us to the actual engine of this entire process. We've looked at the flawed math, the impossible geometry, the missing nucleation, and this over-reliance on carbon. But the paper is literally called an energy barrier model.
Yes, it is.
So where does Wang's team think the energy driving this transformation is actually going?
Well, they do have a theory for the thermodynamics. And predictably, Padeshi pulls it entirely apart.
Of course he does. What did they say?
Wang's team equates the strain energy of the displacive transformation to a driving force.
Let's break that down for everyone.
Sure. So when the lattice changes shape, it creates strain energy. Wang essentially believes this energy acts as a physical force that pushes the interface's dislocation structure past obstacles in the surrounding austenite.
So they're treating the strain energy like a physical battering ram or a bulldozer, just using raw force to push the metal through the solid steel.
Exactly. But Padeshi corrects this using basic thermodynamic principles. If the energy acted as a driving force to push past obstacles in that manner, the energy would be dissipated as heat.
Wait, heat?
Yeah, it would work exactly like ordinary plastic deformation, which is what happens when you, say, permanently bend a piece of metal back and forth until it gets hot and snaps.
Oh, like bending a paperclip until it breaks.
Exactly. The energy is lost to the system as heat.
But in this transformation, the energy isn't lost.
No, it's not. The strain energy generated by the shape deformation of the ferrite is actually stored elastically inside the steel.
Stored elastically.
Right. It is preserved within the structure. Any valid thermodynamic model of this transformation must account for that stored elastic energy.
So what does this all mean? Wang thinks the strain energy is acting like a bulldozer, grinding past obstacles. But Padeshi points out that a bulldozer generates massive friction and that energy is lost as heat.
Correct.
The physical reality is that the energy acts more like a coiled spring. It's stored elastically inside the steel itself. And if your mathematical model treats a coiled spring like a heat-generating bulldozer, every single downstream calculation you make about energy barriers is going to be utterly compromised.
That is an excellent way to conceptualize it.
Yeah.
You cannot build a functional energy barrier model if you don't even understand where the energy actually is or what form it's taking.
It's impossible.
If you miscategorize stored elastic energy as dissipated heat, your entire thermodynamic ledger is completely invalid.
And I absolutely love how Padeshi caps off this entire critique.
Oh, the conclusion is brutal.
It really is. In the source text, Wang's team seemingly prided themselves on the conciseness of their method. But Padeshi completely dismisses the need for their convoluted math.
What does he say?
He states, "What is concise about the method? Here is a 10-second physically correct way to estimate the W's temperature." And then he just provides a vastly simpler approach grounded in actual observation.
It is such a powerful reminder that complexity does not automatically equal accuracy.
Not at all.
You can build the most complex, mathematically dense, heavily parameterized model in the world. You can factor in molybdenum, invent resistance forces, decouple differential equations.
All the fancy tricks.
Right. But if the basic physics are wrong, if you treat springs like bulldozers and ignore the fact that plates stop when they hit a physical wall, your model is entirely unhelpful.
Padeshia's 10-second method is superior not because it's mathematically fancier, but because it is actually anchored in physical reality.
Exactly.
So let's bring this all together for you. Why should you care about a highly specific academic debate over the start temperature of Widmanstätten ferrite?
Because you probably aren't going to be forging industrial steel anytime soon.
Probably not. But this deep dive perfectly illustrates a universal trap that exists in literally any analytical field.
It really is the trap of model drift.
Yeah.
It is what happens when highly intelligent people fall so completely in love with a complex theoretical framework that they begin to ignore the basic reality right in front of their eyes.
Exactly. It's the danger of tweaking variables just to make your spreadsheet balance out, even if it means inventing mythical forces or, you know, pretending atoms can just pass through solid walls.
Right.
Whether you're coding software architecture, analyzing economic market trends, or just trying to solve a logistical problem at work, this is a glaring reminder to always anchor your work in physical, observable reality.
Don't let a beautiful mathematical equation blind you to how the world actually functions.
Which leaves us with a final, rather provocative thought to consider long after this deep dive ends.
Yeah, and think about this. We just saw how a peer-reviewed paper published in a major respected journal was pushed through to publication despite relying on mathematically contradictory models that fundamentally ignore how atoms actually move.
Even after they were warned.
Right. So it forces you to wonder how many other accepted models governing our modern technology, from the algorithms driving our financial systems to the neural networks powering artificial intelligence, are mathematically elegant on paper, but built on physical impossibilities.
It is a genuinely unsettling thought. I mean, the math might look absolutely perfect, but you always have to check if the foundation is actually built on mythical forces.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us and for bringing such a rigorous, eye-opening, and fascinating topic to the table. This has been an incredible masterclass in critical thinking and keeping our feet planted firmly on the ground. Until next time, we're signing off from the deep dive.